On today's blues edition of the show, we have an interview with one of the first musicians to be called a guitar god, Eric Clapton. Early in his career in the 60s, he led the British blues revival as a member of the bands Cream, the Yardbirds, and the Blues Breakers. The blues remain his prime inspiration, and his recent records have been enormously popular. His 1994 record From the Cradle went double platinum. In 1993, he won 6 Grammys for Unplugged. Terry talked with Eric Clapton in 1989 about the inspiration he got from black blues performers when he was young. She asked him how he discovered their music.
When I was a little boy of about 9 years old, I think I heard a couple of records on the radio just being slotted in different variety programs that were by blues musicians from America. One was quite popular, actually, in England. It was called Whooping and Hollering by Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee. And it was an instrumental thing with harmonica and guitar and country blues, really, fast country blues. And then I heard also Big Bill Brunsey, who was quite popular in Europe during the 50s and early 60s, and a fantastic guitar player and a great folk artist, you know. And I was, I don't know why, I was immensely attracted to the sound. I was immensely attracted to the spirit of the music. And I decided to kind of examine it, investigate. And so I became a blues collector, buying export blues records at export shops. And I got finally into people like Muddy Waters and Robert Johnson and all of the country blues players. And that's really where I got all my influences from to begin with.
Did you teach yourself guitar?
Yes, there was no one else interested in the kind of thing I was interested in. It was a very strange, unique phenomena that I was probably one of about 4 or 5 people in England, I guess, that at the time that were interested in that particular kind of music. So it was quite lonely, but I was dedicated to it. I loved that music, and I wanted to play it.
What were some of the greatest frustrations of being self-taught?
Not really knowing that, for instance, when you pick up a 6-string guitar, and I didn't know how to tune it, you know. I mean, just basically didn't know how to tune it. And I refused, you know, I mean, a quite arrogant way to buy the books, you know, buy even those Teach Yourself How to Play Basic Guitar books. So I had to learn how to tune the guitar on my own.
And those books had awful songs.
Well, yeah, that's what, you know, Old Black Joe was the kind of...
Exactly, yeah.
Obligatory kind of song. I couldn't stand that stuff, and I refused to do it any other way but my own way. And then the next step was, once, if you considered you had got it in tune, was that if you put your fingers on different frets and then tried to make a chord, I was under the impression I was inventing all this stuff, you see, and in actual fact, it was all being done before, but it was a great... I prefer to think of doing it that way because I felt like I was discovering it all.
You were learning the blues as a white Englishman, and you were very removed from the lives of the bluesmen whose music you were emulating. Was there an element of romance in your mind to what the blues musician's life was? And did you know anybody who was remotely like the musicians whose work you were listening to and trying to play?
I didn't know anybody at all that I could identify with in that way. But to the first part of your question was that, yes, it was incredibly romantic. I could identify in some aspects in that I came from a very poor country background. And so, that I mean, I was kind of maybe like a white counterpoint of in the English South, you know, except there wasn't a racial situation at all. But we were very poor, and it was like... You know, I imagine it'd be quite similar to somewhere in Mississippi. I don't know, maybe not, but I tend to identify with it in that way. And I kind of dreamt of myself being this this lonesome blues singer, you know, at a very early age.
Do you remember the first time you actually performed with a black blues musician?
I think I think it would have been Sonny Boy Williamson. Yeah, and I was already in a professional band called the Yardbirds. I was around 18 years old, and Sonny Boy had just done a tour with the Country Blues Festival through Europe, and he decided that he would like to stay in England and make some money, because it was possible then for blues performers like himself to go through Europe and make an incredible amount of money, which more than they could dream of making in America. And the Yardbirds were somehow linked up with him through the management people to do a tour of England. And I met him and was incredibly scared of him. He was a very, very, a frightening man. A very nice man, but he had an attitude that he could adopt at any point that was really quite terrifying. Apart from that, musically, he was so inspiring that it was the first taste I had of the real thing, you know.
And what was your reaction to it?
My reaction was very mixed. First of all, I think you get into this. I was very possessive about the blues, and I thought that being that I was one of the only people playing in England, I tended to think that I owned it around that time in my life. And to meet someone who was real doing it made me feel a little bit ashamed. A little bit possessive and a little bit resentful about the whole situation, and all mixed up at the same time with overawe, you know. And the whole thing sort of seemed very bewildering to me as a phenomenon, you know. It was a bewildering experience.
We know you use the word playing with someone who was real. It makes me think that you thought of yourself as not real, not...
Well, it was a bit of a kind of phony situation when you think about it. I was English, I was white, and I was dedicated to and playing the blues, or what I thought were the blues, but it was all in an unreal situation, and all derived from records that I bought or listening to the radio, and quite contrived, really. And I deliberately was trying to live what I assumed would be a blues man's lifestyle, you know, bumming around with a guitar on my shoulder. And to meet the real thing, who was... And see, Sonny Boy blew a lot of the myth away by being incredibly interested in money and women. And, you know, I had set myself up to think that, you know, a blues man was far, far above these kind of earthly pursuits. You know, I thought that it was much, you know, a blues man would be dedicated to his music and nothing else would matter. And it really wasn't like that at all. You know, it was all down to flashy suits and fast cars and... you know, the stuff that you like in life. And it really kind of shook me up.
So how did it change you?
Well, I guess I started to adopt a lot of those attitudes myself, you know, at a fairly early age. And musically, it meant that I had to get my act together, you know, because... I think that what happened with the Yardbirds was that I was one of the only ones that wanted to. The rest of the guys were... We were all a little bit intimidated by Sonny Boy, but I think the others were more than I was. You know, I was attracted as well as intimidated, and I wanted, after that, to carry on in that lifestyle, and that the others wanted really to go in a pop music direction.
You were early in your career with the group The Yardbirds and playing a mix of blues and pop, and you left the group after the band really started to get a big hit, which was For Your Love. And
yeah.
My understanding is that you left because you thought that the song was too pop and that the group was getting more commercial and going away from its blues emphasis. I wonder what you think listening back to that record now. I mean, I think it's a really good record, whether it's whether it's blues or not.
Yeah, I think it's a good record. if I hadn't been part of the band, I thought I probably would have liked it then too, but it seemed to me a huge threat at the time. And
I thought because it was taking you away from what you wanted to do?
Well, a very big disappointment, you know, because it was kind of like going out with a girl and then finding out that, you know, that she likes, I don't know, you know, Sly Stallone when you like Robert De Niro. Do you know what I mean? It's like all your tastes suddenly start to diverge, and it was heartbreaking. It was really actually very heartbreaking, and one of the first real big disappointments in my life, because to start out with, the band was very unified in our likes and dislikes, and then I noticed that they became more kind of interested in what the, you know, Freddie and the Dreamers were wearing on stage and things like that. So, I don't know, it just really floored me. And for a while after I left that band, I really considered packing it all in because I didn't think anyone else, you know, cared about it the way I did.
What did you do when you left the band?
I went and stayed with a friend of mine in Oxford. He's a friend of mine who was a pianist first and then became a woodcarver. And he had left the band and he was carving a Tang horse as a method of sort of his way of retaliating against the rest of the band. And we sat up in Oxford and just drank wine and ate pigeon pie for about 3 or 4 months. And then John Mayall got in touch with me and asked me if I'd join his band.
Well, you joined John Mayall with the Blues Breakers, and the emphasis there really was on authenticity and on playing as closely to, you know, the blues records that inspired you as you could get. Was that a satisfying experience?
Yes, it was. I really enjoyed working with John, and I now kind of regret that I left the band so early because we'd only made one record, really, which later on seemed to become a classic, and I think it's a classic record. It would have been nice to have furthered it a bit more, and I know he'll agree with me with that, but I guess I was young and impetuous, and I wanted to go my own way. You know, I found my feet so fast with John's band that it seemed like the world was my oyster, you know.
Let's listen to one of the Blues Breakers records. My guest Eric Clapton sings and plays guitar on this one. This is the Robert Johnson song, Ramblin' on My Mind.
I'm going down to the station, cast in a fast new train to see. I'm going down to the station, cast in a fast new train to see. The sun, so, and the sun got the blue about me.
After the Blues Breakers with John Mayall, you formed Cream with Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, and you've said that you liked Jack Bruce's irreverence, that you liked him for not trying to be authentic, bluesman.
Yeah, he came in from another area altogether, and he was one of the first musicians that was, and Ginger too, but Jack, in a much more easily identifiable way, was a rebel, musical rebel. You know, he came from a jazz background, and he was like one of the first fusion players I'd ever met who was willing to cross jazz into blues and rock and roll all at the same time. He didn't see that there was a musical boundary, and he was a very intellectual, one of the first musical intellectuals that I met. He was deeply into classical music and modern classical music at that, and I was for quite a while under Jack's spell, because he seemed to me to have, you know, the most unique and avant-garde attitude towards music that I'd ever met.
We're featuring a 1989 interview with Eric Clapton. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Clapton. Why don't we listen to the opening of one of Cream's best-known records? On something like Sunshine of Your Love, which has this now really famous opening lick, do you consider that part of the composition, or is that something that, that was added afterwards, and who came up with that?
Well, that's Jack. We went to see Jimi Hendrix. Jimmy was a dear friend of ours, and this was like 1967. There was a theater in London called the Savile Theater where everyone at the time was playing, and we went to see Jimmy play there, and Jack and I were in a box looking down, and I think it was the first time Jack had really listened to Jimmy properly, you know, and he was overwhelmed. And that night he went home and wrote that riff, and the song was actually written on the riff. It wasn't added, you know, that wasn't the... It was the other way around from the way that you think. It, mm-hmm. You know, we didn't add the riff to the song. We added the song to the riff.
And Crossroads, which is one of the Cream records that I think you must have initiated. It's a Robert Johnson song that I'm sure it was you who decided to record. You do the vocal on it. It was one of the few Cream records that you were the solo singer
on. Yeah.
Tell me why you wanted to record that.
I'd had the Robert Johnson album for many years by then, and I was pretty well familiar with all of the songs on there, and I thought that was the best one. I mean, I always wanted to do Robert Johnson's songs in different... I mean, the first one I did was with John Mayall. I did Rambling on My Mind. And
which you sang also, yeah.
Yeah, and then but then with Cream, each time we made a record, I would find some way of arranging a Robert Johnson song to put on there. But mm-hmm. Crossroads, to me, was the one that summed up... I didn't know it then, but I guess it must have summed me up in many ways, but it summed up Robert Johnson's story, you know.
How do you think it summed up your story?
Because I've been at that crossroads many times in my life in many different ways, musically, personally, business-wise, just geographically. I'm often at that place, and I kind of follow my own nose. I don't really know where I'm going a lot of the time.
What did the whole Clapton is God period have on you? What effect did it have on you when people were writing that kind of graffiti on walls?
Well, I don't think I actually ever saw it. You know, isn't that the funny thing? I don't think...
Is this all apocryphal? I mean, I can swear I've seen it.
I've only ever heard it said, and I've seen a picture of a wall uh-huh. in London. And it's a funny picture. There's this brick wall in London with Clapton is God written on it in white, chalk or paint, I don't know what. And at the bottom of the picture, there's a dog peeing against the wall. You know? And that kind of sums up my attitude towards it. But I don't think I've ever actually seen it in the flesh. So it's all something that I've had to accept from other people. And... As far as that goes, it's a bit like someone kind of paying you the highest compliment they can think of, and in that respect, I've tried to learn to accept it graciously.
Mm-hmm.
First of in the early days, I would just I was thoroughly disgusted with the whole thing. But as time has gone by, I've learned to say thank you.
Eric Clapton spoke with Terry Gross in 1989. His new album is Blues: The Secret Sessions. He tours in Japan in November.